Welcome to our podcast, Brain and Butter. Today's episode of Brain and Butter will be hosted by Flora and myself, as our podcast aims to translate psychological and neuroscientific ideas into tangible, short bits of information that anyone can digest. We have a bit of a philosophical topic to kick off our talk. We're going to touch upon what guides us to live a good life and how we shifted from seeking the guidance of philosophers and preachers and started orienting ourselves towards science for these answers. Additionally, we will address how art changed the revolution of technology and how that impacts our everyday life, given that we have access to varied tools that can create beautiful art with only a couple clicks from our computer.
To answer these questions, we invited an art and ethic expert, Thies van der Werf, who enlightened us. Thies is a lecturer, teacher, and researcher in the field of arts and ethics at the Zuid University of Applied Sciences in Maastricht. He is trained as an interdisciplinary scholar of health sciences, cultural studies, science and technology studies, philosophy, and has worked in different fields ranging from academia to community arts, all the way to art festivals. It's a pleasure to have you here today, Thies.
Welcome. Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
To start off our conversation, you mentioned in your work that ethics guides us on how to live in and what to do in modern Western society. What do you think is the guiding norm today, and how has it changed from previous decades?
We immediately go deep. That's good. Yeah, maybe so the question of how to live well, how to live good, what is the good life? These are actually very classical questions for classical philosophers. Mm-hmm. Aristotle, Plato, all these philosophers were talking about these kind of questions. And often in our contemporary society, which is in the West, I'm talking about the West, very affluent, also secular society, this very question of the good life, we have for a long time been a bit outsourced out of our public debate, because our answer is since 18th century, 19th century, is that it's the individual liberty to see how you pursue your own good life. So the pursuit of happiness is an individual quest. And there's no government that tells me how I should live my good life, in the secular West I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that this question went away, obviously. If you now go to bookstores, the biggest shelf is that of self-help. And for the readers or the listeners at home, half of these shelves are filled with books about neuroscience, for example, how the latest findings from neuroscientific research help you to become less of an asshole, pardon my or how to live better, be better parents for your teenage brain kids, or how to be more productive using mindfulness, all backed by neuroscientific research. So to sum this a little bit up, we used to have church fathers, philosophers, who would help us in this question of how to live well, who gave us advice. Now we tend to look for the answer to science and technology. So in a way, science and technology have taken over this advice role to support us with this never-ending question of how to live well.
Mm. So you think that science basically replaced the church in a certain degree?
Of course, not for everybody, right? So there's a lot of people who are still religious or attend church and find also meaning in the teachings and in church traditions, etc. So I'm not saying that everybody, but if you look more broadly to society, quick look on the risen self-help literature shows how we use other sources to answer this question and not necessarily the sources of philosophy or religion.
And how do you think art comes to the picture? Do you think it also shifted, like the impact or the role of art in our modern society compared to how it was in previous decades?
Good question. There's so much art. I mean, art has always been a source for comfort also.
Yeah.
One answer could be that the role of art has changed because of our society in the past 50 years has changed so dramatically. If you now look at job advertisements for any job, any office job in our knowledge economy, then you see skills in the job application mentioned like flexibility, creativity, out-of-the-box thinking.
Yeah.
All kinds of skills that used to be only attached to the artist. now we all have to be artists for some reason. I do see that this also does something to the role of the artist in society.
Yeah, I agree, because I feel that more and more creative jobs are required and all positions require a certain level of creativity. So, yeah, basically everyone is an artist in a way, or needs to be, or it's required. And how do you think...
You could even argue that this is a democratization of art made possible by technology, right? We are all now able to create content. Here, you're making a radio program using a laptop and a mic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And your skillful heads and curiosity, obviously. But this was not possible 30 years ago so easily. So everybody can create content right now.
Not only that, we all have access to it.
We have access to it, exactly.
I have headphones in my pocket, the size smaller than my fingernail almost. And it's pretty wild. And so in this bordering futuristic world, technology has an exponential impact on our lives. Having this instant access to art everywhere, maybe that is part of the reason why in every job, like you said, they're wanting these artistic qualities, usually reserved for more of the artistic community, but now in more of the analytical community as well. Do you think technology is the reason why this change for this demand of artistic qualities in the analytical world is coming about?
It's a big driver of that change, obviously. Yeah, I think so.
How do you think art has changed because of the growing access and ease of creation?
Yeah, if in this debate, there's many skeptical voices and many more optimistic voices. It depends on how you assess the technology. Of course, if you just look broadly, so many more people have access to music, to our online art platforms. So the kind of scope of art has increased tremendously. At the same time, it also has led to some precariousness in the art world in a way, because if everybody can create something, what is then left of the role of the artist? That's a skeptical voice you sometimes hear, right? I'm not so convinced that that's such a problem. I think this world, like you actually said, it screams for curation. I mean, if there's so much content, you need some people that guide you through it based on some kind of expertise.
Yes.
And therefore, we used to have people who do that in museums, who create exhibitions. We also used to have that on radio shows, people who selected music, curators, programmers. But especially, you also see often that artists become more like curators of an art practice. Mm-hmm. And actually, I find that super interesting that young artists nowadays can collaborate and also have to collaborate with a lot of people, because there's so much expertise out there that they can use in the projects. That also does not make sense to want to be able to do it yourself, all of it, right? So young artists working with programmers, working with technicians, working with scientists in labs, for example. So these cross-fertilizations of art and different domains I find tremendously interesting, because there you can see new things happening.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think of the quality change of art? Because I think in previous decades, it was relatively easy to spot a talented individual because they could craft something beautiful, or they could paint or make music very beautiful. But now with technology, we get basically easy access where everyone can craft something beautiful. And then how do you select those who have something special? Like, what is the talent nowadays to distinguish these special individuals?
Yeah, that's also a very good question. Well, artists nowadays have to collaborate more, or will collaborate more. Then social skills become very relevant, more so than maybe before. But of course, you can still make autonomous art in the sense that you do not have to. You can still stick to your craft and make beautiful sculptures or paintings or whatever. You don't have to do all these things. I think if you look at from a broader picture, it's interesting to see how quality and criteria of good will change because of all these developments. So how will AI affect what we deem to be a good painting?
Mm-hmm.
Some people say, well, AI will be able to, at some point, create art that is indistinguishable from human-made art. Could well be. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I still believe that a trained eye, or a trained professional, or trained amateur for that matter, because they work from passion, will able to see the difference. But that will also probably mean that quality of what counts as good, maybe at some point we have good AI art, and good human art could well be.
Mm.
Whatever that be. I wouldn't know.
Mm.
Actually, recently an AI-generated artwork won first place at an art show, and that evoked a quite strong response from the audience.
And the artist, Jason Allen, used a platform called Midjourney, which is an open AI platform.
And he created his masterpiece by telling the AI how exactly he wanted it to look. So you need to give a very specific text prompt to the AI. And how the whole AI system works is that the text has an image pair, and based on a lot of comparing and translation, AI can quickly start searching for an image when you give it a text prompt. But you could wonder how it is different from our own creativity. Are we really unique then in that regard? Because a lot of artists started to wonder if then we can be just completely replaced by artificial intelligence. But then how are we creative? How does it happen in our brain? What happens in our brain is in a seahorse-shaped region called the hippocampus, where past experiences and future ideas freely float together. And novel ideas arise when these distant elements couple together. So the difference between us and an AI system is that the AI always needs a text input to start with, while we don't. So developing ideas and evaluating them and making changes are functions that originate within us. So it might be that an AI system can provoke a huge reaction from the artist community and create beautiful artworks, but it cannot create things from its own. Or at least not yet.
Do you think then part of the role of artistry is deviating somewhat from skill and almost more into imagination? And who can imagine something more creative, more original, more something, whatever we're grasping at?
If you think about imagination, I think we have become quite poor in the sense that it's very difficult to imagine, if the whole world is on your fingertips, it's very difficult to imagine something else. And that's also a backlash you saw with every technology invented. You always get a backlash of a counter-reaction. And for a while you saw that in the art world too. I think it's now more merging, but in the beginning of the internet, for example, like in the end of the 90s, 2000s, first 10 years of the 2000s, you saw a lot of craft work surfacing. People started knitting again, woodwork, as a response to the digitalization of daily life. In some spheres, that's still going on. So back to warm materials, to wood, to natural kind of materials. But at the same time, I think the idea that there is an analog world and a digital world, it's already passé. We're already beyond that. Digital is infused with our daily world. So there's no use to speak of analog digital anymore. So why not make a sculpture that also exists digitally in a VR space in the same way? So that's more interesting, I think.
Since you're also an expert in ethics, especially in relevance to art, do you think AI art is a form of theft from artists?
Oh, that's a super nice question. There's a whole debate about it. Huh? So can AI have ownership, for example? Or what does ownership mean, actually? Or authorship, I should say. I mean authorship. So what does authorship mean, for example, if... And I've come across this question with students, our students who work with AI and then use an algorithm that was made by somebody else. And then the question was, is that then the author of that algorithm, the programmer, is he part of my artwork? I find it a super interesting question. I don't have an answer to it in the sense that depends on probably you need somebody with a law degree or very skilled in how these laws work with Creative Commons, etc. You can think about something. But I basically, it's very interesting to see when does, for example, a piece of software become aesthetic part of your work? When is that? Is that in the process? Because you could also compare it to, say, you're a painter and somebody made the paint for you in the paint shop. Is that person also an author of your work or not?
Mm.
So for there, we're quite clear, no. But maybe the line is less clear when art is produced through algorithms, partly.
Do you think that's driven by the audience and how prevalent different specialized members of society exist in that audience. For example, if you had a bunch of paint makers as your audience, I feel like they might really enjoy looking at the quality of the paint mm-hmm. behind the painting. So that might be a rare scenario, but today we have an exponentially growing amount of programmers. So now maybe at some point the audience will just enjoy looking at code or something.
Oh yeah, they do. Do you know the phenomenon Algo Raves?
No. Wow.
These are parties in, I don't know if there's already, I think they still exist. 2 years ago, they were very popular in UK and also parts of the US and the Netherlands. And they were programmers who were live programming as DJ on evening. But they were not using existing sounds or DJ sets, but they were live programming sounds.
Wow.
Live programming. So people were hearing the sounds, but also looking to the screen how he was programming it.
Wow.
And she programmed. It was a very feminine also community.
Cool.
Very cool. So, that's already happening. But at the same time, this discussion is also not that new in a sense. I mean, ever since we had performance art and participatory mm-hmm. art practices where audiences played a very important role in the artwork or community arts, there the question of ownership, of authorship is also always on the table. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you work together with people from the neighborhood to create a collective artwork, who's the owner? Everybody's the owner or not. Or there's no owner. So authorship, I always keep saying ownership. Authorship, because ownership is a different question. Yeah. But authorship, so who is the author? Who is the creator of the maker of the work? Is distributed among people in many different art forms. So the question rather is, if you talk to a painter, if you talk to an artist, they know that material does something in their work. They know that their material in a way speaks back to them, the mm-hmm. sculpture, the stone, the paint or the canvas, so the clay. So there's always there's always been a kind of relational togetherness with the artist and its material.
Mm-hmm.
Only on the end of the process we say, okay, the artist made that, but it's also the material who played a role in that. And mm-hmm. there's many philosophers, especially philosophers of technology, who have been thinking about, okay, how can we grant objects agency? Or nature, for example. But there was this part of the rainforest in the Amazon got granted juridical rights to prevent, how do you call it?
Deforesting
there of the Amazon. And that's something that a few philosophers have been arguing for decades already. One of them recently passed away is called Bruno Latour, who talks also about the Parliament of Things, for example. Maybe that's a bit of a far-fetched, but if you look at that, and it's not so, then things like individual accomplishment or individual authorship are not so simple categories anymore. If the work is distributed between people, stuff like algorithms, materials, audiences, I find this perspective makes it also much more fruitful to look at these things than stick to individual.
Yeah, definitely. And without the tools, we would not be able to create like any tools, like the specific art that we are talking about. So I think that is definitely important. And I do feel that with technology, a certain population of people got interested in art who were not really interested before. For example, programmers or people who love to code and the good with AI, they didn't have the skills or like, because I feel that previously art was more selective, more for a certain population of people. But now, since the tools are available, more people are actually interested and enjoy making or doing art because they have the actual skills. So now programmers can make beautiful paintings with like DALL-E or Midjourney or like all these programs, and they start to enjoy it. So I think it also gives space for more creativity in a way.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, but it still mostly is what you put in it, you get out. So if you put shit in, you get shit out. Sorry for my language.
It's not a magic box, that's true.
Well, Tees, thank you again for joining Brain and Butter. The takeaway message is that technology is changing where we go for guidance and the secret to a good life. Art has become widely available for everyone thanks to technology, and this same technology allows all of us to create content so easily that creativity, distinctiveness, and modern authorship all have new topics under debate. What do you think the answer is? Post your opinions and find us on Instagram under the hashtag BrainAndButter with two R's.